From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 4 years after 9/11, President Bush is still drumming home the war on terror.
We know that this war will not be won by force of arms alone. We must defeat the terrorists on the battlefield, and we must also defeat them in the battle of ideas.
Yesterday in New York, the president took his message to the UN.
We have a solemn obligation to stop terrorism in its early stages. We have a solemn obligation to defend our citizens against terrorism, to attack terrorist networks and deprive them of any safe haven, to promote an ideology of freedom and tolerance that will refute the dark vision of the terrorists.
Since September 11th, bloody terrorist attacks have hit Tunisia, Mombasa, Jakarta, Bali, Istanbul, Madrid, London, and above all, Iraq. Last year, terrorist attacks around the world tripled in number from the year before. In Iraq, in the month of May alone, there were 90 suicide bombings. Yesterday, more than 150 died in bombings in Baghdad. More died there today. Unconfirmed reports say Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, has declared war against Shias, that is, Muslim on Muslim. This is not a jolly war, but it may be the war Osama bin Laden was looking for. This hour On Point, taking stock of the war on terror and imagining bin Laden's view with Bigfoot journalist Mark Danner. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Who's winning this war? Have the last 4 years demonstrated American power or the limits of that power? Is it time for a course correction? Like what? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be joined in a moment by Mark Danner, but we begin this hour in Baghdad with Ellen Nickmeyer, correspondent there for The Washington Post. Ellen Nickmeyer, thank you for joining us. What can you tell us about the further bloodshed there today?
Today there have been three more bombings, at least since sunrise. There have been three that targeted a heavily Sunni Muslim area of the city, and it hit, the worst of them hit at the Iraqi police commandos, which are supposed to be Iraq's crack troops against the insurgents. They killed at least 17 of them, and there were later attacks, two other bombings during the day that killed at least four other people.
I want to be sure I understand what you said. Did you say that the attacks hit a heavily Sunni or Shia area of Baghdad?
The bombings took place in a heavily Sunni neighborhood that's seen as sympathetic to the insurgency, or widely sympathetic.
Now, yesterday, the worst attacks we read singled out a Shiite neighborhood, and with this death toll of about 150 yesterday, it's been described as the biggest death toll in Baghdad since the American-led invasion of Iraq toppled Saddam Hussein more than 2 years ago. Do we have tit-for-tat violence here?
There's totally, there were at least 17 bombs the past couple of days. By targeting Shia Muslim civilians and by targeting Iraqi police, the interior forces, it seems to further the foreign fighters' aim of kind of trying to get a civil war started here. The aim might be to start tit-for-tat violence between the sects going on.
And what's the sense, Ellen Nickmeyer, among Iraqis? Has that civil war begun, or is it still just flames being fanned?
You know, there's widely divergent opinion on that. I've talked to some Sunni Muslim leaders, respected ones, who say the civil war is already underway. And certainly, in past months, there's been dirty wars. There have been lots of disappearances. There have been many killings that the United Nations says are extrajudicial executions, that they appear to be extrajudicial executions possibly by government forces. There's simmering hostilities that by extremists on both sides, but for the mass public, I think the sentiment is they don't want civil war.
And heavy, heavy death tolls in Baghdad. Ellen Nickmeyer, correspondent for The Washington Post, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Joining me now from New York is Mark Danner. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, professor of journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, author of the book Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. His latest piece in the New York Times Magazine was headlined, Is He Winning? Taking stock of the forever war, and that's he, as in Osama bin Laden. Mark Danner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So it's a long piece, a big summary of where we've come in these last 4 years. And at the end, you turn to Osama bin Laden and really kind of help us look back on what's happened in these years, as if through the lens that he might see this war on terror. You say that bin Laden and al-Qaeda have taken hits, but that on balance, he may be satisfied with what's going on. Mark Danner, walk us into that view.
Well, I think if you had sat down with Osama bin Laden on the day after 9/11 4 years ago and said, you know, 48 months from now, the United States would be bogged down in an endless counterinsurgency war, which was supplying images of Americans, American soldiers raiding Muslim houses, American soldiers fighting against Muslim holy warriors, which had stretched American forces to the breaking point, which had tested the patience of the American public, a war that was becoming increasingly unpopular, which had drained the popularity of the president and brought him to the lowest point of approval in his presidency, which had divided the United States from its allies and brought them to the lowest point in relations and in memory. If you had said that, I think, 4 years ago, I believe that Osama bin Laden would probably have replied, this is presumptuous, of course, but would probably have replied, well, I'll take that, because I think it would have been a very unusual analyst who 4 years ago would have predicted this point 4 years on in the war on terror. As you pointed out, the number of attacks last year tripled, according to the State Department, the highest number since they've been gathering statistics. In Iraq alone, there were 200 significant terrorist attacks, and that does not include attacks on American soldiers. Mm. So it obviously dramatically understates those numbers. There have been very large attacks in cities around the world, including, of course, London and Madrid. And some of those attacks have been politically very significant, particularly the Madrid attack, mm-hmm. which led to the defeat of the Spanish government, which had been allied with the United States, and subsequently with the withdrawal of Spanish troops from Iraq. So I don't want to paint this as a completely black and white picture here. It's obvious that the United States has killed and captured many al-Qaeda forces, particularly many operational forces below, obviously bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, and has severely damaged the network itself of al-Qaeda. On the other hand, if you look at what's happened to al-Qaeda as an organization, I argue in the New York Times Magazine piece that we've really seen a transformation, partly under American pressure, of al-Qaeda into al-Qaedism, that is, the group itself, the network itself, becoming, in a sense, an ideology that's being followed by increasing numbers of sympathetic Islamists around the world, many of whom are staging attacks without having been to training camps in Afghanistan, in some cases without having any direct contact that we know of with al-Qaeda itself. They're able to find instructions, very detailed instructions on the internet, how to make bombs, how to carry out terrorist bombings, how to make suicide vests. It's all up there, very easily found.
Mark Danner, let me ask you if I may. There's so much to dig into here, and I want to take it piece by piece, if you'd be so kind. As I read into your analysis here, it's not really defeatist. It's a kind of a get real, if you want to come out of this in one piece analysis I'm reading. And there's a lot to look at here about how al-Qaeda is working and not working, what progress has been made and not made. But part of understanding where they're headed is what their goals are. You've looked at that, and you're describing them as closer to their goals now than they were 4 years ago. I guess winning or not winning might be judged in those terms. Why closer to their goals now?
Well, it's interesting, Tom. After 9/11, the president, President George W. Bush, set out very clearly in front of Americans a picture of what al-Qaeda is and what its goals are. Essentially, he told the American public and the world that this was a group that embodied pure evil. Its goal was essentially to destroy the United States, mainly because the terrorists, as he said, hated our freedoms. They hated the American system. They hated what the United States stood for. And this was their motivation. And as I write in the piece, this was a very familiar line of rhetoric in American history. It underlay, in particular, the Cold War. And it's very successful, partly because of its familiarity in rallying the American people to a cause.
Was it wrong?
It was at minimum very incomplete, almost to the point of being irrelevant. It essentially ignored the fact that this group and the broader number of people who sympathize, if not with its methods, then its aims, believes that the United States is the key power standing behind regimes that they want to remove. That is the Jordanian monarchy, the Mubarak regime in Egypt, and above all, the Saudi royal family.
And if America can be shown as less than all-powerful, they feel closer to their goal.
Exactly. They're trying to supplant these regimes, which they call the apostate regimes, replace them with Islamic governments. And since they have been unable to remove the regimes directly, because these are, after all, authoritarian states with very efficient security services, they've decided to attack the United States.
So we've got to take a short break here. Please stand by. We'll come right back. There's a lot more we want to hear. We're looking at Osama bin Laden's likely view of the war on terror. Is it presumptuous? Yes. But if we don't understand it, what do we know? You can join the conversation. Have the 4 years since 9/11 shown American power or the limits of American power? And when bin Laden looks at the world, looks at Iraq, what do you think he sees? What do you see? Who's winning? Who's moving closer to their goals? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back with Mark Danner. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Osama bin Laden's likely view of the war on terror. My guest is Mark Danner. His most recent article in the New York Times Magazine is headlined, "Is He Winning? Taking Stock of the Forever War." You can join the conversation. What do you think? Does the United States have the will to win this struggle? What is this struggle? What does winning mean? Does staying in Iraq get us closer to the end goal? Does leaving Iraq get us closer to a solution or a new world of pain? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Try and put yourself in Osama bin Laden's shoes this hour. What do you see? Mark Danner, I'm just looking at the headlines straight out of Baghdad in the last 24 hours. This is just straight off the wires. The deadliest day since the U.S. invasion of Baghdad. Here we are, you know, years later. Explosions hitting Shiite civilians, Iraqi security forces, American troops, and we just heard from Ellen Nickmeyer, maybe a response on this next day hitting Sunni civilians. Let's look at Iraq in particular for a moment through the bin Laden eyes, as best we can imagine what they might see. What do we know about how al-Qaeda may see what's unfolding there?
Well, we know that one of the main leaders of the Islamist forces in Iraq is a man named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who heads a group that he calls al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. Mm-hmm. They have claimed credit for the dozen attacks yesterday, a dozen full-scale attacks in a very short time, which shows, first of all, that this group is able to mount a massive number of operations in the country's capital.
And almost at will, this on the very day of the UN General Assembly opening, everyone gathered there when the President Talabani is in the United States. It seems they want it right now. They get it right now.
Yes, and the Prime Minister, Ibrahim al-Jafri, is also in the U.S. It does show, obviously, that the current government and the United States forces on the ground are not in control of the security situation, as if we didn't know that. But it's a further demonstration of it, the ability to mount 12 operations nearly simultaneously in the capital of the country is a pretty decisive demonstration that these forces can act at will, and that however many of them have been caught and killed and captured, they are still very powerful and very capable of operating on the ground. And the security situation is deteriorating steadily in Iraq. And it is supplying images, as I mentioned before, of a terrorist force, a guerrilla force, able to operate at will.
And the importance of that image again, in bin Laden's shoes, indeed, if he's sitting somewhere in frontier Pakistan, nobody knows. There's a lot of presumption in this whole conversation, but yet he's not caught or dead or in jail, as the president promised, so we have to assume he may be out there or others with his agenda. The significance of for their larger goals of what they're seeing in Iraq.
Well, again, as you say, it's presumptuous, but I think we can make a couple of statements about that. One is that they are trying to make of Iraq the new Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda emerged in the struggle against the Soviets in Afghanistan during the 80s. They consider that they defeated a superpower in Afghanistan in a war that eventually led the Soviets to withdraw and led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Iraq, in their view, is the scene of a similar battle against the United States. It's the place where they can take on American forces, where they can fight them with guerrilla techniques, where they can show the Islamic world, all the Muslims who are watching, that the United States can indeed be defeated. It can be defeated by determined and heroic resistance by guerrilla forces using the most desperate techniques, obviously suicide bombings, but also the most effective. And, you know, there is a sense in which Iraq is now serving as a kind of recruiting poster for the cause of jihad. And what's more, defensive jihad, that is, it's much more obligatory, if you can put it that way, for Muslims to fight a jihad when it has to do with freeing Muslim territory that is occupied by an infidel.
And this is not just your hook you're hanging this on. You quote CIA Director Peter Goss saying very explicitly exactly this.
Yes, exactly. Porter J. Goss said, you know, the jihadists in Iraq who survive are going to go on to create cells in other countries. They're going to have been blooded and trained. They'll be hardened veterans of jihad. And this is, of course, similar to what happened in Afghanistan during the 80s. Al-Qaeda, the meaning of that is the base, as in the database. In other words, it essentially began as a listing of all the jihadists from around the world who went to Afghanistan to fight in the cause of freeing a Muslim country from occupation. So there's something very parallel and very similar here in Iraq.
Let me ask you, if I may, al-Zarqawi now explicitly, reports are coming out, declaring war on the Shia in Iraq, the majority population of Iraq. Of course, there's a fault line through the Muslim world. Shias in Iran and large parts of Iraq, Sunni in much of the rest of the Middle East. What is the point of pushing for kind of internecine warfare within the Islamic community?
Well, we know a lot about this because Zarqawi has not been shy about explicitly stating what his goals are. He wants to incite a civil war, which will do a couple of things. It will, first of all, cause Sunni to fight on his side. In other words, they believe that Shia are essentially heretics, that they're really not true Muslims. And by provoking them, this is a very familiar terrorist or guerrilla strategy. Mm-hmm. You're a small group. You don't have the power to actually win. What you can do is provoke your adversary, your larger adversary, to act in such a way that he will cause a rising up of your potential allies. So by provoking the Shia, he hopes to get the Shia to repress the Sunnis and provide him essentially with more allies. What he wants to do eventually, and he has said this explicitly, is start what would be a regional civil war.
Why? Why?
Why? Again, he wants to cause the Sunnis to rise up in a continuing struggle that would lead to eventually the overthrow of what he calls the apostate regimes, among which, by the way, he now numbers the Jafari regime in Baghdad.
So he believes that that a civil war between Muslims would bring Sunnis onto their feet, and that would then bring the overthrow of the Saudi government, the Jordanian government, Egypt, and so on.
Precisely, and the Jafari government in Baghdad as well. But yes, he wants to – essentially he wants them to be enlightened and realize that they have to fight for their rights, that the Sunnis in Iraq are being repressed. And, you know, it is to some extent working. That is, you know, you're having the foreign – the so-called foreign fighters tend to be coming, insofar as we know, there have been a various numbers of studies of this, from over the border, from Saudi Arabia, from Kuwait, from the Gulf countries. I mean, these are young Sunni men who are coming over to help their Sunni brothers in Iraq. So, you know, as you pointed out, Iraq lies on a fault line. I mean, it's in effect the sort of Yugoslavia of the the Middle East. It lies on the fault line between Shia and Sunni. So you have the Iranians on the one hand supporting what is in effect a Shia government, what is a Shia government in Iraq. And you have Sunnis coming over the border from neighboring states supporting the Sunni insurgents. So you have, you know, in effect a civil war, low-level civil war going on there. Now, people are talking, you know, there's a common phrase, there could be civil war. But the key question about civil war in Iraq is how would we know? What would be the thing that would determine that it was a civil war? Because it's starting very much to look like one right now, an internecine struggle between sects.
Now, let me ask you on this issue of political will. You've said that that is critical to bin Laden's thinking here. That these regimes in the Middle East stand because it is presumed that there's an all-powerful superpower standing behind them. And that if American will is seen to waver, then you might get this uprising you describe. George Bush, I'm sure, would say, "Dear Mark, we are showing that will. We will stay the course. We are not stepping out of Iraq. This is a huge demonstration of American will. 150,000 troops, nearly $200 billion. What do you want? This looks like political will made manifest on a grand scale."
Well, I think that bin Laden would answer that in very clear terms. First of all, he would say, "American will? Are you kidding? You've never supplied enough troops. It's been very clear from the beginning, from the first stages of the war, that you had not enough American troops on the ground. Everyone said it. The commanders have said it. Commentators have said it. It's been obvious. You've never had sufficient control of the country. It was looted wholesale from top to bottom under your own, the gaze of your own tank forces. And what did you do? You didn't send more troops. You still don't have enough troops." That's the first point. The second point is, when we look back at American history, recent American history, bin Laden has a particular reading of it. He sees Beirut in 1983 when a truck bomb killing 241 American troops and Marines in the barracks in Beirut caused the United States under Ronald Reagan to abruptly withdraw from Lebanon.
And then the same kind of thing in Mogadishu. But isn't George Bush refuting that with this big, unyielding presence in Iraq or not?
Well, remember that they have a much different view of time than the American electorate and the American political system does. They look at this war and say, well, they've been there 2.5 years in Iraq, and what do we have? We have the same number of troops. They haven't increased it. We have a deteriorating security situation. We have an incipient civil war. And we have, if you look at the United States, absolutely plummeting approval ratings for the president. He's now in the low 40s or high 30s, which is unprecedented for him. And not only for the president, but plummeting approval ratings for the war itself, in which fewer than 4 in 10 Americans think it was worth fighting. You have very low support for it. And you have an election coming up, a midterm election in 2006. And General Casey, the commander on the ground, has said explicitly that there would probably begin to be a drawdown sometime in 2006. You also have, I should mention, a situation in which the American military is stretched to the breaking point. The reserve forces and the National Guard are in meltdown, as General Barry McCaffrey told Congress recently. You have a situation in which the major combat units of the American government have all served in Iraq, most of them twice. They're not supposed to be sent back to the same conflict for a third tour.
But it's happening.
So you have a very serious problem within the military itself. If you're looking at this, you know, on a longer time scale, not 1 year or 2 years, but 5 years or 6 years or 10 years, from bin Laden's point of view, this is going to lead to a drawdown of American forces one way or another.
So let me ask you then, because you put it right out there. You say Americans confront a stark choice, and Americans don't like a situation where there's no good choice. But here it is. Let me just read it as you describe it. Americans confront a stark choice, whether to go on indefinitely fighting a political, self-destructive counterinsurgency war that keeps jihadists increasingly well-supplied with volunteers, or to withdraw from a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq that remains chaotic and unstable and beset with civil strife, and thereby hand al-Qaeda and its allies a major victory in the war on terror's central front. I mean, this is damned if you do, damned if you don't. Where's the light here?
Well, I agree with you. Americans don't like that kind of choice presented to them. We live in an op-ed culture, by which I mean that there always must be the nut paragraph, which says, I've described to you, dear reader, how horrible things are. Here's the solution. And I must tell you, Tom, that I don't think there is a real solution here.
But there are American troops over there on the ground dying, so that's not good enough for any American leader to say there is no good solution. I mean, we have to point at something.
And that is why I thank heaven that I am not an American leader, because I can simply tell you what I think. And what I think is that there isn't either course that I set out in that bleak dichotomy. Either course is – each of those courses is a bad one.
If we stay, we're essentially raising a jihadist army. If we go, we hand it to the jihadists. Simple as that?
Well, it's not quite as simple as that. I think that, you know, I propose very sketchy terms in that piece, because that wasn't really the point of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
But
fair enough.
That there has to be, in my opinion, the only way to retrieve that situation, and I don't think it can be totally retrieved. Mm-hmm. I think it was a mistake to do this. I think it's quite obvious it was a mistake to do it. And you can't recover from all your mistakes. But I think what I would do if I had to plan our policy is I would be trying to get right now a regional solution that would recognize implicitly that none of the surrounding countries, including Iran, really sees it in their interest to see Iraq implode. They want a stable Iraq. They don't want a failed state in the territory of Iraq. And all of them have certain interests that with clever diplomacy and a firm demonstration of American will and the ability, by the way, or the willingness to recognize reality, which this administration has been notably deficient in showing when it comes to Iraq. But if you could have all those things, you could come up, I think, possibly with a regional solution, which would essentially give to the Saudis and the Jordanians and others, would say, look, you have to clamp down on your borders. You can't let these jihadists through. And in exchange, we're going to secure Sunni rights in Iraq. It would say to the Iranians, you know, you have to help us secure these rights by leaning on your Shia allies in Iraq.
And maybe somewhere on that path, a little bit of light. I want to get at least one call before the break, Mark, if I may. A lot of people have been waiting. Nazar's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Nazar. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I agree with your guest 100%, but there is some correction or some expansion on in his comment.
Give First it straight all, to us, Nazar. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's going to take a lot. I wish if you give me extra time, because it's a really complicated story. First of all, I want to talk with Bush, because Bush, always when he comes, he said, I want peace in the Middle East. I want democracy in the Middle East. I want to do this. But if we look at, if we take it as a logical, there is a lot of reformers from the Gulf country. They are in exile in Europe.
In exile in Europe, okay.
Yeah, they never actually, I never see any dialogue between them and the United States.
So the U.S. isn't supporting those Democrats in exile who might go back and build democracies.
Because there are professors in university in England, for instance. They have speakers. They are from Saudi Arabia, from the Gulf country. But I never actually saw any dialogue. If really the United States wants, at least there is a dialogue between those people to move, to bring them back. To their country and form the country, because 90% of the population in the Middle East, they want to elect qualified people for the government.
They want democracy. Nazar, your line is rough, but we've got that point, and let us run with it. Mark Danner, we've just got a minute before the break. Nazar says, where is the U.S. really standing up for democracy here? George Bush says it's right now in Iraq.
Yes. Well, it hasn't escaped the view of the people in the region that apart from Iraq, if you look at other regimes, Mubarak, for example, the Saudis, the major backer of the authoritarian regimes is none other than the United States, despite the professions of democracy that it makes. But there's a deeper conundrum here, which is really obviously behind that. And that is, if you had an election, for example, in Saudi Arabia, who would be elected? And it seems to certainly be the opinion of most experts that I've read, and most in the American government, that you would have an Islamist regime elected in Saudi Arabia if there was a free election there.
So, Mark Danner, let's hold the thought there if we may. We have to take a short break here. It gets murkier and murkier. We're looking for the light. Listeners, what do you think? Is it possible? Is bin Laden winning? And what will it take for the U.S. to get real? and win. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Mark Denner.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Osama bin Laden's likely view of the war on terror. Our guest is Mark Denner, author of an article in the New York Times Magazine last week, Is He Winning? Taking Stock of the Forever War. He's a professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, staff writer at The New Yorker. You can join this conversation as well. What do you see? Who's winning? Who's moving closer to their goals? What would it take? What will it take for the U.S. to get real and win, for peace to win, for democracy to win, justice, call it what you will, something good? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. William is calling from Davenport, Iowa. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Yes, I agree with your guest that some agreement could be developed between the bordering countries to Iraq.
Yep, get the region involved.
My question is, could we start off by putting enough troops on the ground to make the peace there and then work the diplomacy afterwards?
Very simple, straightforward, practical question. We'll pick it up. Mark Denner, if we put another 100,000 troops in, it's a little late. General Shinseki said 4 years ago we'd need to do that nearly. But if we did it now, if the U.S. did it now, could that put the lid on this long enough to give a more stable Iraq a chance? Is that a way?
Well, it's an excellent question. There are a couple of problems with it, however. The first is that we don't have another 100,000 troops.
Call them up. That's the issue of
our
will,
armed forces,
isn't it?
Well, one could do that. That would obviously take a while. The second problem, though, I think is even more serious, which is that I think the insurgency has reached a point where it is essentially growing partly owing to the presence of the Americans. That is that their recruitment, their propaganda, all of it, is much more effective because if you have the Americans on the ground. I think we've probably passed the point where adding more American troops on balance would help the situation. And I'm someone who believed early on with General Shinseki that you needed a lot more people on the ground. And, you know, the general wasn't simply pulling that out of his ear. I mean, they do studies on these things. And essentially, if you had the same number in Iraq that you had had in Bosnia, for example, it would have been 350,000 to 400,000 troops. So this was not a controversial point within the Defense Department. It's just that Rumsfeld and others discarded it. But I think we've unfortunately reached the point where that is not a solution at this point, in my opinion anyway.
So maybe this is another example of the limits of American power, as powerful as it is being shown. Let's get another call here, if I may. David is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you today?
Well, great. What do you think?
First of all, I make the point that I think that the Bush administration, to the extent that they actually make decisions, I don't know that they make decisions in the normal sense. They strike poses of toughness, and then they react to the disaster that follows. But I think they've decided to let the country fall apart, by the Peter Galbraith model of three states.
That is, let it be Kurdistan and a Shiite entity and a Sunni entity.
In about a year, you'll hear them say, well, we've done our best. Essentially, these people don't know what to do with the democracy we're offering them, and we're going to leave town. But the initial point I wanted to make was that, I think it was back in 95, 96, when Osama declared war on us, he had three objectives. One was to get us out of Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Another was to get, I think at the time, $30 a barrel oil, because he thought we were stealing their oil.
That seemed like a real stretch to get to $30 a barrel.
And he wanted us to stop supporting Israel. Well, he's already gotten two out of those three.
Oil is at nearly 70 now, and the U.S. is out of Saudi Arabia, you're saying.
And the Israelis have just pulled out of Gaza. So what shocks me here is that nobody on Bush's side is accusing him of capitulating. I don't know you know, when the people who are supporting Bush, the minority now, are going to recognize defeat.
So you're giving Osama bin Laden the win, or at least advantage so far?
He's already won.
Already won. Let us sit on that for a minute, David. Thanks for your call. I mean, this is kind of at the scale that you're working here, though, Mark Danner.
Yes, I think those were extremely astute points. Although one thing I would say is that, you know, the fact that the Bush administration took the several tens of thousands of troops, I think it was 15 actually, out of Saudi Arabia. On the one hand, it seems like a victory for Osama, but I think if I were in his place, I would want those troops still to be there.
Because that thorn in the side was working for him.
Well, exactly. You know, it's a very good way to raise support by pointing to those troops, which is why the Bush administration removed them, and they, I think, would justifiably claim that this was one of the benefits of the Iraq War, such as there are,
a strategic
you know, they could
move.
Actually take them out.
You know, you remind us of a fascinating moment back when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And here comes none other than Osama bin Laden racing to the Saudi royal family and saying, don't bring Americans in here. Let me bring my mujahideen, who are battle-hardened from Afghanistan, and let us repel Saddam. Let us make a stand right here. The Saudis refused, invited the Americans in, and you say that is the moment at which he really went south on all the existing structures of power there.
That's right. He essentially broke with the Saudi royal family at that point very publicly, and that led to what we've seen now, you know, his declaration of jihad in various public statements in which he's called for the overthrow of the royal family, among other things. But he did, you know, one would like to have been a fly on the wall during that meeting in which the young jihadist and heir to one of the great fortunes of Saudi Arabia came and talked to the Saudi leaders and said, yes, there are these tanks on the border, but don't invite in infidel forces. I have these guerrillas who fought in Afghanistan. They can come. They can repel or protect the kingdom from Saddam's tanks. And they listened patiently, nodded, you would think, thanked him for his idea, and then ignored him completely. And he hasn't forgotten that slight, because what they then did, of course, was receive Dick Cheney, then the Secretary of Defense in the first Bush administration, and invited in the several hundred thousand American infidel troops to come to Saudi Arabia, to come to the kingdom.
And off we go. Mike is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. What do you think?
Like I told your screener, I hope I can say it as well as I said it to her earlier. Everything you're saying is wonderful. I love you. Love the way you guys are talking about this. But I served in the National Guard, and thankfully I got out before I had to get deployed, on my contract. I know a lot of friends of mine weren't as lucky, and they're there now.
In Iraq,
In Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of seems funny to me that, you know, the government keeps trying to put this in terms that I don't know, I can't say it again, but it was like they have Western ideas are being imposed upon people to these ideas are so foreign. It's almost like Vietnam, where we had the South Vietnamese government set up the way we wanted them to be set up. And, you know, of course, it was foreign to them, and at least to the majority of the people anyway. And those people who played ball, of course, they got, you know, richer and, you know. So you see
Washington imposing its own sense of what's going on a region, and you're not sure they've got it right.
No, they definitely have it wrong, yeah. I mean, if they had it right, I don't think we'd be where we are right now. But, I mean, you can't force your ideas on people. And, you know, maybe the government, what Bush should do is pay more attention to their ideas of what they want to do and let them do what they want to do, and we can leave with honor.
Mike, we've got it, and we appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in. Mark Danner, there's a National Guardsman who got out of the Guard before he got sent to Iraq or Afghanistan like his friends. And he raises a point that you raise as well, that we bring our own sort of familiar models or molds of understanding to everything we see, including this conflict. You describe the Bush administration as very quickly imposing a kind of Cold War matrix of understanding around this conflict, and you're saying the clothes don't really fit.
Yes. Certainly, if you look at the rhetoric of the administration beginning a few days after 9/11, essentially they divided the world into good and evil, explicitly compared al-Qaeda and the terrorists to the fascists, to the Nazis, to the communists, and said this is very similar. We're good. They're evil. We have to destroy them. This is a battle to the death.
And what's the problem with that?
Well, this comparison doesn't really work. I mean, you know, this is a relatively small guerrilla organization. It is not Nazi Germany. It's not the Soviet Union. It could have been fought quite discreetly using some military means, some intelligence means, but with a clear idea and a clear recognition that their major goal was not to destroy the United States, but to attack it and use those attacks to build support. You know, the major use of terrorism in this instance was to try to build support and recruitment for its own organization. And occupying Iraq in the way we have, in this kind of endless occupation, has done exactly one of the things that they wanted to achieve. I think they wanted to achieve this in Afghanistan itself. They hoped for another Soviet-style invasion that would go on forever.
And there you say bin Laden failed, really, because the U.S. went in light and didn't allow itself to get so bogged down, though there are still a lot of U.S. troops there.
There are. There's still 15 or 16,000 troops. But it's true that, you know, the U.S. did not give Osama the war he wanted in Afghanistan. The American military is light years ahead of the Red Army, obviously, and that war was fought in a very different way. But I think your caller makes another point as well, which is that there are echoes of Vietnam here, I think, in at least two ways. The first is that it's extremely hard to fight a successful war when you're depending on a political situation that is extremely unstable, and that is the situation
in Iraq.
That was the situation in South Vietnam. It is in Iraq right now. And the second similarity is that if you're going to fight a war, you'd better well have the support of the American public. And to get that, you've got to be frank about what the interests of the country are and how long the war might take. And the administration was frank about neither of those two issues. In fact,
are you so sure President Bush talks a lot about a long, 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 long war?
Yeah, but he sold the war. They also – well, I'd make a couple of responses to that. First was, you know, we had a lot of rhetoric coming from the vice president and other officials about how we would be greeted – American troops would be greeted with sweets and flowers. This would be a very popular thing in Iraq. That's first. Second is, of course, they sold the war. The war was fought, I think, for a number of different reasons, but they chose to sell it to the public and to the world because in the cause of disarming Saddam of his enormous arsenals of weapons of mass destruction. And of course, that was the one reason that could be falsified. It was falsified. And the result is that the very area that Osama wanted to attack, which was American will, was left very severely exposed because the U.S. had been sold a war on the basis of one reason, and that reason was shown to be false.
Straight up. And I was struck, and I just have to point to it again. When you raise the Nazi metaphor, that kind of look. But you remind us that 4 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, U.S. troops ruled unchallenged in Japan in Germany. It's now 4 years after 9/11, and it's nothing like a big, clear U.S. victory here. I want to try and get a couple more calls, if I can. Carl's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I want to disagree with your guest about not comparing this phenomenon with Nazism. And another point I want to make is that Bush at the U.N.
Yes, yesterday.
He missed a crucial point that could have been historically consequential if he spoke against terrorism, not as if it was a sort of a flu, but rather a phenomenon, a philosophy, and I would call it al-Qaedism.
We quoted him, we had his tape at the top of the hour saying we must defeat the terrorists on the battlefield and in the battle of ideas.
But he didn't call it in the phenomenon as if, in a similar sense as Nazism was, and they are playing the same game if you listen carefully. And by the way, go into any chat room, any Islamic chat room, and you'll see that the Nazism phenomenon is there, the ruling of the rest of the world.
Why do you think it's like Nazism?
Because it really wants to rule on the rest of the world. Listen to their philosophy. Listen what they're following.
The whole world, not just the Islamic world? I mean, as if that's not enough.
Of course. look, listen to their philosophy, to what it really says. I don't want to say it openly in the air. And if we don't tackle that, then we'll pay the price.
Carl, we appreciate your call. Thanks very much. Mark Danner, what do you make of that?
Well, it's a fascinating point, and George Bush clearly agrees with it. His response, George Bush's, to the philosophical challenge of al-Qaeda was the notion of spreading democracy throughout the Middle East. That is, that was, in a way, a battle of ideas incarnate. You know, we are going to spread democracy throughout this region, and thereby we will end terrorism as we know it. My problem with that is, first of all, it hasn't worked. In fact, it's gone, you know, if you're have a strategy that envisions falling dominoes in which you're going to start one democracy and then all the other regimes are going to become democratic. The problem is that if it fails, you can have the dominoes falling in the other direction, in the direction of failed states. My other problem with it is that whatever you think of Osama's broader philosophy, they did not represent a threat to the United States on the scale of Nazism or Soviet communism. They just didn't. I mean, this is a small organization that uses guerrilla techniques, in particular terrorism, to try to build a constituency around the world. It is not a state of 40 mm-hmm. million people. It does not have a large industrial capacity. It just is not a similar threat at all. A lot of its threat is propagandistic. And terror, the propaganda of the deed, is the way it works. And we have essentially fallen into that trap by doing precisely what they wanted us to do, which is embody what they say we are. That is a power that will occupy Muslims, that will suppress Muslims, that will oppress Muslims. I mean, those images from Abu Ghraib, the image, for example, of the American female soldier, Lindy England, holding a leash around the neck of a naked Arab man lying on the ground with his face contorted in pain. These are they may as well be recruiting posters for al-Qaeda. They basically embody what he says about the United States. And they've been very popular, obviously, around the Middle East.
Mark Danner, we've got half a minute. We've got that, and it is vivid. We've got half a minute. You say it's going to take more will than George Bush has begun to describe. What's it going to take in a nutshell, half a minute?
Well, I think it'll take a smarter way of fighting this war, a way that recognizes American interests and that acts on those interests. It'll take a recognition that the Iraq War, the way it was fought and how it's been fought, was a mistake, that the United States has to realize what the situation is in Iraq and try to retrieve a regional solution there that will work. And that the war has to be fought with much more attention to what my friend John Arquilla calls, he's a counterinsurgency specialist, the battle of the story. It has to show itself that it is not what bin Laden describes it as.
The great narrative, maybe not being won right now. Mark Danner, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the New York Times Magazine piece last weekend, professor at University of California, Berkeley. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.